the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. We're supported by listeners, and I want to thank Steve Wozenski of Novato, California, and Michael Tria of Corning, New York, for their support. You can help, too. Just go to peterbcollins.com, and you can subscribe voluntarily for as little as $5 a month. Today, we present part two of our three-part series, the exclusive interviews with Sybil Edmonds, the FBI whistleblower, who is now ungagged. But she was the subject of two gag orders based on the state secret privilege, and she tells the sequence of events that led to those unprecedented actions and the way Congress acquiesced. It is amazing stuff. You'll hear her tell how Henry Waxman, who once promised to hold public hearings and allow her to testify under oath, now can barely recall who Sybil Edmonds is. Things changed after he had a meeting with Speaker Pelosi in March of 2007. And if you have not yet heard part one, that's podcast 40. I also recommend podcast 45. FBI veteran John Cole affirms the credibility and some of the charges from Sybil Edmonds. Now listen as Sybil Edmonds speaks freely here on the Peter B. Collins Show. I wanted to ask you to sum up for us the sequence of events that led to this unusual gagging of you under the state secret privilege.
Important question, and I'm so glad you're asking this, Peter, because there's a lot of confusion out there, and I can understand a lot of this due to the mainstream media, and I will get to that point. But initially, when I reported this stuff internally, okay, I was focusing on the most important issue that I was reporting, and that was the espionage element, and I was not the only one who was reporting. The first report on this espionage issue was issued by my superior, the agent. Special Agent Dennis Thatcher from the FBI's Washington field office, in writing to the headquarters that we have a possible espionage case and he wanted to have the espionage investigations of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
I got into it after that, okay? Now, so I took this case to the OPR within the FBI internally to the director. Then I went to the Inspector General's office, okay? This is before I went to the Congress. And I'm sticking with this espionage issues, okay? But the espionage issue, the Dickersons, Malik Ken Dickerson and Major, at the time, now Lieutenant Colonel Douglas Dickerson, okay?
Mm-hmm.
When you pursue that espionage case, because of them, you end up already looking into those operations that these two people were involved in, because Douglas Dickerson used to work for Mark Grossman in Turkey, and while he was in Turkey, as we will have this interview that we did with John Cole, was under investigation by Pentagon for receiving bribery from foreign agents, okay? This is Douglas Dickerson, and he's working for Mark Grossman. Mark Grossman is under espionage investigation.
Right.
At the time when I reported this case to IG and OPR, Douglas Dickerson worked for Douglas Veit in Pentagon, okay? So that's who he worked for. He worked for Douglas Veit. Now, both people... Dickerson were members of ATC, okay? They were working with ATC, all right? And I have documents from the Air Force, and please remind me, I can send it to you. It's a PDF document.
Mm-hmm.
You can put it on your site. I got a letter from Air Force confirming Air Force IG that Douglas Dickerson worked with American Turkish Council. And this is Douglas Veit's office, and under it they said it was within his official capacity and duty that he was working with the American Turkish Council. What kind of official duty are Pentagon people have to work with lobbies?
Yeah.
Okay? I have this letter. It's signed and sealed by the Air Force IG. So I reported this espionage case, which by default involved the targets of investigations, why they were important, because she used to work. That means she got checks. Her tax statements showed that. Her tax filing showed that. Melikan Dickerson. She worked for ATA DC and ATAA. One of her jobs while she was working for ATAA, this Turkish organization, FBI target, was she was liaison to Turkish military defense attaché in Washington, D.C. under Turkish embassy. Okay, you're looking at all these targets. So here's a woman who used to be employed. Not only she associated, she was employed by this organization. She was paid by them, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I took this stuff. I reported it, that the espionage case, that was the important case, and I went to the Inspector General's office. When I went to the Inspector General's office the first time, I was accompanied by my attorneys, two of them, okay? And in fact, during the first meeting, we were accompanied, my attorneys and I, with the two high-level staff from Senator Grassley's and Senator Leahy's office, okay? They walked us in, and they had a meeting, 5-10 minutes meeting, before we started the first meeting with them, telling the IG that this was extremely important because Senate had already done his its investigation and accumulated a lot of information, confirming all my allegations, okay?
Right.
And they wanted IG to do an expedited report, so they have an executive branch report on this, in order for them to proceed with hearings, investigations, right?
Mm-hmm.
So IG office, under Glenn Stein, they promised Grassley and Leahy's office that this would be expedited, and within 3 to 4 months max, they would issue a report. This was in April 2002. So the Senate expected this report, and we were promised that this report would be out by September 2002, okay?
Right.
Guess what? This report didn't come out until end of 2005, which we will get to that. So my attorneys and I, we sat with these Inspector General's office people, and I started telling them about the issues, and I said, well, and then part of it has to do with the targets of investigation, some of them U.S. persons involved in these criminal activities that these Dickersons are connected with, right? At this point, in front of my attorneys, IG investigators stopped me and they said, Ms. Edmonds, because of our jurisdiction, we can only pursue the administrative matters and this Dickerson's because it relates to personnel, FBI personnel management background check.
Mm-hmm.
The other aspects of your case that deals with the U.S. persons, you're looking at Hasters and Grossman, et cetera, that's not within our jurisdiction. Once we issue our report in September, 4 months from now, then we will forward that part of it to the special prosecutors at the Justice Department to go on and pursue those aspects of your case, okay? So they wanted to wash their hands clean of that part from Grossman's and Hasters, even though inside the skiff I had to and I gave them some of that information. They said, we want to stick with anything that is administrative. And the espionage in terms of Dickerson's, how in the world she was hired, how she was, those still can be included under administrative, right?
Okay.
With this promise on the record, and my attorneys took notes during this meeting, dated notes, that we were promised that the special prosecutors in Justice Department, after September, will take over and pursue the criminal aspects of it, which would boil down to the Douglas Dickerson, Mark Grossman. That was the initial promise. As you know, the Inspector General's office sat on that report until 2005, end of 2005. Then they redacted more than 90% of the report. If you haven't seen the redacted version, you have seen the unclassified version. I'll send you the redacted version, where you see that more than 90% of the pages are white out. They are not blacked out because they go with the white markers.
Yeah.
And I will send it to you. You should have that on your website, too. So that report basically was nothing. But even that nothing, 10%, was incredible because Inspector General's office never issued that on whistleblower cases to come and vindicate and say the espionage case is the one that they confirmed, and they had other witnesses and other documents saying that the FBI should investigate this, and it was appalling that they did not pursue investigations on the espionage matter.
The Inspector General issues that report. but not until 2005. So what occurred between the fall of 2002 when you were expecting this report?
Right. So I'm expecting this report. I'm expecting, based on the promises we were given, my attorneys and I, that there's going to be this big public hearing by the Senate Judiciary Committee, bipartisan, Senator Leahy, Senator Grassley. And I am at that point, Peter, I am so stupidly naive. I'm believing everyone. I have done everything right. I went to the executive branch, IG, and the Senate. They have already confirmed these. They're going to have big hearings. And then these special prosecutors is going to pursue the criminals, right? Then the report didn't come out in September. Then they came October, and I stopped getting calls from the Senate. I'm calling them. I'm saying, why they are not issuing the report? Well, we will call them. Well, what are you doing? Are you going to have the hearing? We are still looking into it, and we are waiting for the report. Then those calls cease to exist. And then on October 18, I was in London. I was celebrating my wedding anniversary. It was, and I got this email from my attorney saying the Attorney General Ashcroft just invoked state secrets privilege in your case. And under that, my attorney, and it's supposed to be confidential, but hey, I don't have a case any longer, it said, what in the world is it that you know that they are so afraid of? ? From my attorney. My attorney's got freaked out. Now, my attorney had to go to the library and find out what the hell state secrets privilege meant, because nobody ever had state secrets privilege issue publicly known. Bush administration's first state secrets privilege case was me, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I went into Google. I put inside bracket. I put state secrets privilege. I got 7 results, 5 of them repeat. One of them was the Reynolds case, okay? And another one had to do with some weapons company, either Lockheed Martin or somebody's case, and was just cited. There was nothing. My case, my name, brought the state secrets privilege into Google, and until 2004, if you did state secrets privilege, you would get 35,000 to 50,000 hits, and for only one case, the Bell Edmonds case. And this was when I paused. I'm like, something is happening here. The IG report is not coming out. The Senate stopped calling me, and now I'm issued this gag order state secrets privilege. Okay, I was there for only 6.5 months. And with my attorneys, we sat and started talking about it. Think, why do you think they're doing this? This is when I started looking back at the operations that I was investigating, I was translating, the investigations I was translating for. And what I brought up to the IG, the fact that the U.S. persons are involved, and I knew it was not Dickerson's. Dickerson's name was already out. The CBS. It was not to protect Dickerson's name.
Mm-hmm.
It was not the fact that I was a whistleblower, and I went to the IG. I knew it had to do with the operations I was translating for. 96 till 2002, those files. Main file, Chicago. Second file, operations here in Washington, D.C. And this was when I knew, well, who are they protecting? Dickerson's names are out. Well, Hastert's name was not out. Grossman's name was not out. Mm-hmm. The primary targets that we haven't talked about, I haven't talked because I can't disclose still. Those were the ones they were protecting, and why they were going to this thing to protect those. And as time went on, I found out every day more and more, because after the state secrets privilege, after they invoked it successfully, they invoked it again for the second time. I'm the only person in the U.S. who has had state secrets privilege second time invoked twice. I'm a very privileged person. So the second time was in the 9/11 family members. The attorneys, the monthly rights attorneys, they subpoenaed my deposition. Attorney General invoked it again. And then, 3 months after that, the Justice Department issued gag order in Congress via retroactive classification, saying all those statements that Leahy and Grassley made publicly about me, including their statements that is listed even in CBS 60 Minutes transcript, the letters that they had on their website, they had sent to Mueller saying, we have confirmed this case, what are you doing about it? They said, all those have to come off your website. From this now on, you cannot refer to this case, you cannot talk about this case, because because we are retroactively classifying all the public information you have put, including your own statements. This has never occurred, Peter. Never. Granted, New York Times published it front page, okay? This is the first time Congress is being gagged in this case by a retroactive classification. New York Times, Eric Lichtblau did a good job, and they put it on the front page. This was the first time the news made it to the front page. Because grass effect, it's never happened. First of all, executive branch doesn't have the jurisdiction to come and gag the United States Congress by a retroactive classification. But they went along and they complied with it.
Yeah.
And this was when I knew, no way, with my court stuff, they stopped the Congress, okay? There's only one way left, and that is the media. The public to know via media, investigative journalists.
Now, Sibel, this is remarkable that the Justice Department would issue a gag order on the Congress, which is a whole different branch of government, and we're supposed to have separation of powers in this country, and that it was retroactive. They were telling Grassley and Leahy, senior senators, that they didn't know what they had previously known, and they had to scrub it from their websites and make things disappear. This is bizarre and unprecedented, at least in my knowledge of American history.
You're absolutely right, exactly. And the worst part, actually, is what you haven't mentioned, is the fact that they complied with this illegal gag order. Right after the gag order by a retroactive classification was issued, and this was like end of 2004, 2 years plus after these senators had made everything public in terms of their statements, the letters they had sent to Director Mueller, the fact that they had interviewed FBI insiders and they had confirmed my allegations, etc. You know, thousands of websites had downloaded those letters. It was widely circulated all over the web. So when they issued this retroactive classification, a bunch of organizations came out and challenged it, not really in court, but they said it's illegal for these reasons. Number one, the separation of branches, but also for retroactive classification alone, there are supposed to be three criteria that the Justice Department or any agency has to fulfill, and that Ashcroft did not fulfill or took into consideration those, at least two of those criteria. So therefore, mm-hmm. It was illegal. Yet, these senators, just like sheep, they complied.
Yeah.
They pulled everything off their website. You can go and look at it, including CBS 60 Minutes transcript, which FBI, DOJ said they had to pull it up because now they considered it classified. Now, the transcript for CBS 60 Minutes segments were already out there, and CBS website has it, but the senators actually pulled off their transcript. It was that bad. And from that date on, I never had any contact with these offices. They stopped taking calls from me, and they ended their relationships, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And they deserted me, both Senator Grassley and Senator Leahy.
Yeah. Well, let's include Congressman Waxman, because he was on the oversight committee. He's since moved over and chairing a different committee in the House. But when the Democrats regained control in 2006, you were sitting on a promise from Henry Waxman that he would investigate, and I believe he said he would allow you to testify.
Correct. In fact, I was promised that one of his first hearings was going to be on my case. I had two meetings with his staff, with the staff who had clearance and inside the skiff, so I could talk about classified issues. And exactly that's what happened with Congressman Waxman. Now, one of the people from his office was conscientious enough to contact me, and not from his office or her office, and tell me this bizarre incident that took place. Congresswoman Pelosi called in Waxman into this meeting about my case, on Sibel Edmonds' case. And that meeting lasted for about, they said, 15, 20 minutes, this person said. And Waxman came out of that meeting and told his staff, we no longer touch Sibel Edmonds' issue. We no longer are involved in Sibel Edmonds' case.
Wow. What was the approximate date of that? Do you know?
Actually, I have the exact date because I wrote about this. I believe Luke Ryland wrote about this. It was around March 28, 2007. And March 29, 2007. And interestingly, and again, this may be only a coincidence, I'm not sure, Pelosi had this junket for a visit to Israel. And Waxman's name was not in that junket. After that meeting, a few days after that meeting, his name was added to the junket. Now, was that related? Who knows? But that's what took place. And as I said, a person from his office was conscientious enough to tell me that this took place. And I haven't heard from Congressman Waxman's office. He has been questioned about my case during some of his town hall meetings, sometimes in camera, and he actually feigns ignorance. Sibel, who? That is his response. I don't know personally about that case. But I have letters from Congressman Waxman when I was working with his office on hearings for whistleblowers on national security whistleblower laws. I have letters addressed to me signed by him personally, yet his acting performance is quite remarkable. He says, wow. Sibel, who? I don't have a personal knowledge of that case. Right.
Wow. That's stunning because, you know, Waxman is one of the people who we look to, particularly during the dark ages of the Bush administration, as a fighter who really believed in congressional oversight.
Absolutely.
But when we look at the actions, though, Sibel, during the 2 years when Bush remained in the White House, but the Democrats were in control on Capitol Hill, it's still a sorry record of one-day events and stunts that were, you know, to embarrass or to, you know, throw a story out there. But they didn't pursue any of these with the kind of vigor and determination that you would expect and that they should have due to the outrage that these issues raise. So this is a very stunning, willful failure on the part of Democrats to pursue these issues. And someday we may know what kinds of deals were struck. But we can only speculate at this point that deal-making did occur and that you were traded away.
Absolutely. In fact, you're right. In 2004, end of 2004, I went to Projects on Government Oversight, POGO. And I said, because of the Senate, I'm looking for the cleanest, by cleanest meaning a congressman or a congresswoman who doesn't have, you know, too much of shady past and who's not too materialistic in terms of campaign donations, et cetera. And POGO is pretty informed on these issues. So I said, I want to go to the cleanest person. And they recommended Congressman Waxman, rightfully so. They said, he's a squeaky clean. In fact, that was their exact phrase. He's squeaky clean. In fact, his nickname is Monk, from the episode of Monk.
Yeah, detective.
Right. So POGO representatives actually went with me to my first meeting. They took me personally. So we went there together with Danielle Bryan and her husband, who is the investigator for Project on Government Oversight. And they actually sat outside the skiff when I went inside and briefed on classified issue, Waxman staff, because they had faith in him. And yes, based on all their research, and as far as I know, he is clean. He's supposed to be really clean and honest and good. Mm-hmm. So it's nothing personal as far as Waxman goes. But, you know, yet this was the result. And you're right, because the Democrats, including Conyers, they have been what I phrase as old bark and no bite.
Yeah.
You know, the threats, and it gets old after a while. And also the fear. I always bring up the fact that more than the foreign agents using this information against our congressional people, I feared the Justice Department, the FBI, using this information, the information they collect on these congressional people. You know, you saw what happened just a few months ago. It made the headline. Congressman Conyers' wife is under investigation.
Well, she pled guilty.
Okay, so you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Now, how far they would go with her maybe depends on how Conyers is complying with Justice Department. He wouldn't want to push too hard because they do collect these kinds of information, whether it's Jan Schakowsky, whether it's Conyers, whether it's Hastert. And they may not be very blunt because they don't have to be very blunt. when Senator Grassley and Senator Leahy, they demand for Director Mueller to come and answer some tough questions, Director Mueller may whisper and say, you know, Senator Leahy, there is this issue of so and such that we were thinking of looking at, and I want to talk to you about that too. That is enough to have these people to back off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not conspiracy, Peter. It's a fact. It's a fact of life. It's a fact of politics.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the director, and I want to play another sound clip here from John Cole. As we mentioned earlier, he's a retired FBI agent. He was there for 18 years. He was a manager and an agent, and he was in charge of counterintelligence. At times, he was in charge of the desk related to Turkey, Israel, Pakistan, and he is quite knowledgeable. And in particular, we have two different clips here of citations of different high-level people from the seventh floor. That's where Director Mueller's office is, and that's where the top-level FBI executives work. Confirmation not only of what you have charged and your accuracy in doing so, but also their deep concerns about what would happen if and when you went public. Let's listen to John Cole.
I didn't know Sibel Edmonds prior to the article coming out in the Washington Post. I think it was in June of 2002, where they said two whistleblowers, came out. I read that article and had my name in it and had Sibel Edmonds' name. And when I went back to work the next day after that article came out, I asked somebody, I said, who's this Sibel Edmonds? And they said, a woman that I know, a female that I know, that worked up on the seventh floor, which is where the director's floor is at. All the executives are up there. She told me, she goes, well, all I know is that everything that Sibel is stating, this is what she told me. She goes, everything that Sibel is stating is true. She goes, I read her file. Everything she stated is, in fact, accurate. And she goes, the seventh floor better figure out what they're going to do about her, because she's completely right. And I said, well, and then I asked her, I said, well, how can I get a hold of her? I want to meet with her. I want to talk to her and compare notes with her. And she told me, she goes, it's best you don't get in touch with her.
You're too radioactive. It was best that John Cole not get in touch with you. Now, he ignored that advice, and we're grateful for it. But, Sibel, as you hear his characterization, and we have another person he cites that we'll get to in a moment here, were you aware that high-level officials knew exactly what you had learned and that you weren't making this up and that you were not a spy? Did they understand that you were operating with clean motivation and with clear information?
Absolutely. In addition to the individuals, nameless individuals, John Cole cited, there were several others within the FBI headquarters and also the FBI's Washington field office who were actually supporting my case internally. And some of these individuals, when they were summoned to go to Senator Grassley and Senator Leahy's offices for those investigations that they were conducting there, they actually confirmed all my allegations. They actually shared their knowledge of the case and the facts involved. And, like, for example, in one case was this person who was in charge of polygraph. That person told the Senate offices that the FBI tampered with Dickerson's polygraph in order to prevent this whole fiasco of espionage from getting out of hand. So they actually, that the fact that the FBI management on the top, they tampered with polygraph result of Malachi and Dickerson, and they shared that information with the Senate Judiciary Committee. And as far as radioactivity, yes, I had several senior language specialists that I had established friendship with, relationship, and one by one, they contacted me either in person or by phone from their homes, and they said they were told that they had to cease all communication and contact with me. You know, this one particular woman who was a Russian translator, she says, Sibel, I am ashamed of myself, but I have two more years to retire, okay?
Jeez.
And I can't F this up.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to hear from me. No emails, no phone calls. So they seized all their contacts with me. But until, you know, that point, I was being told that there were so many people, both within the FBI headquarters and the FBI's Washington field office, who were supporting my case. They were cheering for it. This is why it's very important to distinguish between the some bad people in the FBI and many, many good people. As far as the agents were concerned, they were all solid good. They were all supportive, both before I was terminated and based on what I was told afterwards, behind the scenes. And the same with people that I'd never met who were familiar with my files. I mean, these individuals within the executive division in the FBI headquarters, I didn't know, and I don't know any of these individuals. But besides John Cole, other agents, Agent Gilbert Graham, other agents who have retired since, they have come and said, you know what, you have a lot of supporters there. You have many supporters in the FBI. And they have been talking about the fact that you have been accurate, and these are the people with first-hand knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sibel, before we get to the next clip, I want to ask you a point-blank question here. It's clear that there's still a lot of information that you are not sharing because of the agreements that you signed when you went to work at the FBI. And I'm not going to ask you to disclose anything that is impertinent or not proper to disclose. But with the whole raft of information that you have disclosed and what you're unable to disclose, is there anything in there that you think created a legitimate concern on the part first of the FBI, then of state and defense, and ultimately at the White House, that goes beyond embarrassment, that goes beyond illegal behavior? Was there anything that they feared you would disclose that really legitimately would have risked our national security?
Not a single thing. There are several categories of sensitive areas, okay? One is, if there is an ongoing investigation, okay, that would be damaged, that would be ruined because of disclosure, whether it's criminal, whether it's counter-espionage-related investigations. I know for a fact that the issues that I have been talking about, I have come forward, all those investigations, all those intercepts, they all ended. They all ended by January, February 2002.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody can cite ongoing investigations. As far as methods of intelligence gathering, those are completely irrelevant to the issues. I have never talked about those. There is no need to disclose those because they are irrelevant. It does not matter. As far as the kinds of activities, none of those activities had anything to do with sensitive information to protect the Americans' security against whether it's terrorism or criminal. It was just the opposite. All these activities were against the Americans' national security, against their interests, against their political belief system. These were criminal activities, with the victims being the American people.
Well, criminal and treasonous, because this goes beyond, you know, a simple bribery deal, because our secrets, including military and nuclear secrets, were up for grabs and offered for sale by traitorous Americans.
Well, these secrets, Peter, they're only secrets for as far as the American people are concerned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we spend tens of billions of dollars a year protecting classified documents, you know, the stuff that the Americans can't go and receive under Freedom of Information Act, classification, secrecy. As far as our enemies are concerned, as far as most of the foreign allies are concerned, we don't have any secrets because they have access. Money buys access. So Pakistanis have far more access to these secrets than even a lot of our officials in our country. So these secret documents, the secrecy, and most of these secrecies is to protect the executive branch, protect our government from accountability, really. Because if people know, then people demand based on what they know. It is secrets from the American public.
Very well put. Now let's listen to this second clip from John Cole, where he identifies another unnamed individual at the seventh floor of FBI headquarters, and he does say that this person was an assistant director. So that is at the rank right under Director Mueller. Let's listen carefully to what John Cole tells us. Aside from the woman on the seventh floor that you referred to, was there any kind of a buzz that we've got to silence this woman, that this is dangerous for the FBI, dangerous for the U.S. government, could expose ongoing investigations? I mean, some of it could have been put in legitimate terms, and others, like you just cited the woman on the seventh floor, seem to be suggesting that a cover-up was in order because this information was not only true but highly explosive.
Well, exactly. And there was an executive assistant director I used to talk to all the time, and I talked to her about it. And she said one time, she goes, well, if, you know, the Bureau's going to have to try to work something out with Sabell, because they don't want this to go out and become public. And I said, well, I think it's kind of late for that, you know. But I know they didn't want her to go out and speak about it at all. And I know they were trying to figure out ways of, you know, keeping this whole thing quiet because they didn't want Sabell to come out. The thing is, the position that Sabell was in, she was... she had access to extremely sensitive information. The translators have access to some of the most sensitive information that we receive. I mean, we have stuff that is just mind-boggling, the stuff that comes in and the translators translate and we get. And they have first-hand knowledge of it before anybody else does because they're the first ones to translate it, and they say, wow, look what's going on here. And then they send it to the investigator, and we put the pieces together and say, okay, now this is pertinent to my case here, or this is pertinent to this, and or we send an IIR out to the community saying, you know, this is something you might want to be aware of. This has implications that may affect even the White House or policy. And so you send a intelligence information report out to, you know, those agencies. So what Sabell is saying, I don't doubt whatsoever. I don't think there's no reason for her to lie about it. And she's been accurate on every other point that she's ever made. So what I'm saying is that I know she had access to some very sensitive stuff, and I can see why the Bureau would squirm over her coming out and speaking about some of the things that were going on.
You think you made the Bureau squirm, Sabell?
Well, there are so many points there to actually explain and talk about. The one is one very well-known, well-respected investigative journalist. We all know this person. Just wanted to just do some fishing expedition and get some information from his very, very high-level source, who happened to be the second highest-level person in the Department of Justice after Ashcroft. On my case, just on general terms, and this person, and this is the assistant to Ashcroft, told this journalist that they actually were called into a meeting with State Department and Pentagon officials, very high level, and this was after hours at the Justice Department, and this was when the decision to invoke the state secrets privilege was made. Now, who made that decision? It was not Ashcroft. It was people, these high-level officials from the State Department and Pentagon. And after that, John Ashcroft, a few weeks after that, came and invoked publicly the state secrets privilege on October 18, 2002. they tried very hard, okay? First, one of the first things they did after I left, and I went to, and I hired attorneys, and I went to Congress, first they went, and this is very classic, you need to interview a lot of these FBI whistleblowers, including Fred Whitehurst, Dr. Whitehurst, because they did these things to him also. And he got this information once he was able to get the information under FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, and that was after fighting it in court. They tried to go and dig up dirt on me, okay? This is the FBI, okay? So I'm talking about the agents, they're not at fault. They were told to go and find dirt on Sabell Edmonds to see what they can blackmail me with, okay? Mm-hmm. My attorneys started getting calls from my ex-boyfriend from 19 years ago saying that FBI showed up in front of their house. Did she smoke grass? You know, did she have any kind of sexual, you know, weird twist in her? Can you believe that they would spend the taxpayers' money to go and chase my ex-boyfriend's back then it would be 15 years ago. Now it's 19 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They came back empty-handed, which makes me a very boring person, Peter, because I guess I should be called a monk, too, in a way, because they couldn't find anything. My tax records were all clean. My criminal record was all clean. We've now been married for 18 years. My family relationships were all in order. They couldn't find anything. So they tried. They tried very hard, and they couldn't find anything. Then in 2004, this is when I went to for the first time to the ACLU, and back then it was the ACLU's DC office, and they couldn't take on my case directly, but they had agreements with law firms that did pro bono work
mm-hmm.
for ACLU, and one of these law firms was headed by this former counsel for CIA. So when we went there with the ACLU representative, DC office representative, to their office, this former counsel for the CIA said, well, we did some prep work and we just had some discussion with the FBI, DOJ. Let's sit and talk about what would it take for you to settle this case. I said, what do you mean? Just write a number, a reasonable number. You know, you can't go and write $10 million, about just a reasonable number. I said, are they trying to settle? And he said, well, they want to know, you know, what it would take for you to settle. I said, how could you put a dollar number to the cost that I have? And this is about my family not being able to go back to Turkey for the rest of my life, to see my extended family members, what they did to my sister. I said, how could you put dollar numbers to it? He said, well, that's how it works with the legal, with the lawsuits, with private lawsuits. It boils down to numbers, dollars. That's what lawsuits for. I said, all right. Let's say I give a number. I said, what is the condition? Is the condition a gag order, meaning I have to sign a paper that says I will go away. I will not pursue any of the other. I may not pursue the court case. But in terms of the Congress and the other activities I'm doing, he said, well, that goes without saying. And I don't cuss. I just said, I cuss at that point. I said, basically, screw that.
Mm-hmm.
And all the attorneys in the room, they said, listen, you're not going to be given this chance one more time. And they can spend millions of dollars, Justice Department, drag this case for a decade, okay? And you don't have those resources. So, and with the gag orders, with the state secrets privilege, I know you're idealist, you're passionate, but don't be stupid. I said, it's one thing to settle, but I said, my freedom of speech, my First Amendment is not for sale. I am not going to sign any papers saying that I will not talk about the case. I will not go to Congress. Basically, I will go away. Well, that particular law firm had no interest to represent me at that point, and it took another year until the ACLU took my case directly. So what I'm trying to say here is, yes, they tried very hard to dig up dirt. That didn't work. Put this thing out there, what would it take for her to settle, shut up, and go away? Which works with 99% of the lawsuits out
mm-hmm.
there.
Yeah.
People, they shut up and go away. $500,000 is a lot of money for a lot of people. You know, I retire on this, my retirement may be still there, my social security there. There is no chance for winning anyway. Let's do it. It just didn't occur to me that I would put a price and I just go away. I mean, think about it. Why in the first place I would blow the whistle and go to Congress if I'm going to go and shut up and say, give me money, and I shut up? Because I could have stayed and I could have had money and retirement and stayed there. I was offered a very high-level position. They gave me the first chance to go to the Quantico and start from GS-13 level instead of the regular GS-7. Because for each language specialty you have, you move up by one level for GS with the FBI. At that point, that was the case. So with four languages, three languages, you go already to GS-10. If you have master's degree, you move up two more points, okay? But I could have made $130,000, $140,000.
Mm-hmm.
Why? So it's irrational to go through all that hell and say, okay, now I take the money, I go away.
Yeah.
I just wanted to have justice, accountability. Well, guess what, Peter? I got nothing. They got away with the gag orders. They got away with the state secrets privilege. I spent close to $275,000 in legal fees.
Ouch.
Personal, okay?
Yeah.
And came from our retirement account, okay? We don't have IRA accounts anymore. We had one, and we spend it on legal fees, okay? Nobody has been held accountable. In fact, all these people, they're just rolling in money and fame and great positions and great life.
Now, Sibel, the enforcer of these gag orders, these very unusual orders that are based on this murky state secret privilege, is Judge Reggie Walton. And he sits on the district court in Washington. He was appointed by George W. Bush. And he's best known to Americans as the judge who presided over the Scooter Libby case. But you couldn't get away from this guy. You, your case was supposed to be assigned to judges on a random basis. But if I have it correctly, three different times when these issues were assigned to a different judge, you were surprised to find out that Judge Walton was once again presiding over enforcing the gag order.
You know, I'm so glad you're asking this question because I had a press release on this. In fact, I moved and I went against my attorney's advice. They said it's a suicide to ask for a judge to remove himself because you do that and it's like the politics of the judgehood. And your case is completely screwed when you do that. So you, no attorneys would support that kind of a thing. I said enough is enough. So actually I went finally after years of Judge Reggie Walton and I officially requested the court to remove him and for several reasons. First of all, he was not the judge who was initially assigned to my case. It was a very good judge. I forgot his name, but it's listed under my website because there are tons of documents on this. This judge was pretty good. He was fair. In fact, he is the one who issued this particular original judge the emergency expedited deposition subpoena for the Dickersons because Dickersons were leaving the country. They were running away. And they were going to be in places with no extradition treaties with U.S., so this judge actually issued the subpoena for so they would be deposed. And the military came and fought the case. Anyway, this was the Air Force and then Doug Feist's office. I won't get into those details. And then with no reason cited, in November, December of 2002, we just got this order saying that the notification from the court saying the case has been turned into Judge Reggie Walton. And no reason cited. So we looked into Judge Reggie Walton. Okay, he was appointed by George W. Bush. Before that, during Bush Sr., he was the attorney at the drugs czar's office.
The White House. Office of National Drug Control Policy.
Uh-huh. Right. So, okay, this didn't look good. It looked really fishy. And my attorney said, there's nothing we can do, really. We can't say, why did you change it? Because this is the court's decision, and they will not answer that, respond to that. The only thing that would cause is animosity. Well, that's what they told me, my attorney. Fine. Judge Reggie Walton sat on my case. There was a hearing scheduled for January. 1 week before the hearing, he sent notification saying it was going to be delayed until April. April, let's say April 10. 2-3 days before April 10, he sent. This judge sat for 1.5 years on my case with no hearing. He would cancel every hearing, and he would postpone it for 3 months later. And he would never cite any reason. And of course, he's the judge who granted the motion for the second state secrets privilege also to the Justice Department when the 9/11 family members' attorneys' monthly rights subpoenaed my deposition.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when the Justice Department, they issued this paper saying these were the classified and also covered by state secrets privilege areas in my case, which includes the date of birth for me, you know, where I went to school, the universities I attended.
Well, now, wait a minute, Sibel. I know a lot of women who would like to have their date of birth classified.
So, yeah, this judge, maybe he was thinking that he was doing a favor to me. So this is the judge who went with that bizarre Kafkaesque request to classify my date of birth, my degrees, my master's degrees topic when I came to the United States. So then I forgot which organization, they made public these records of judges, right? the financial background disclosure that the judges have to comply with.
Right, and Walton doesn't disclose a thing, is that right?
He's the only judge where the entire background on Judge Reggie Walton is blacked out. Well, actually, they use white markers, so it's white out. Everything, every single thing. There is no other federal judge. We did research. We went through hundreds of federal judges' background checks. Maybe they would have one sentence or one area. This judge, the entire financial background, business interests, any companies that he may be board of directors, everything is blacked out, Peter. And this was when I said, you know, enough is enough. I want him removed from my case.
Now, that kind of suggests that he was a spook, that you know, he had his own clandestine background. Either that or he was in the witness protection program, which wouldn't qualify him to be a judge.
Absolutely. He didn't want his financial dealings to be known publicly. And I assume he would have good ones because he worked in the most important narcotics-related, the highest level office in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And George, you know, Bush Sr. and George W. Bush, I just leave that up to your imagination of what this man may have in his background. But interestingly, after all this, he was rewarded after Libby's case, too, because he was appointed to the Libby's case, too. He was appointed to the FISA court. So he is now a judge in the FISA court who would oversee the FISA request, the wiretap request under FISA.
Yeah.
These are the kind of judges they like to have on the FISA bench, which also brings into question all the legality of FISA in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Now, Sibel, I have watched with dismay as the Obama administration and the president himself used to teach constitutional law. He appointed Eric Holder as attorney general. And I did not expect to see them actually try to extend some of the bad legal precedents established under Bush, Cheney, and their attorneys general, Ashcroft, Gonzalez, and Mukasey. But I have to say that they actually are worse, that they have used the state secret privilege to block any lawsuits related to the wiretapping and also to block the case, the appeal of Binyan Muhammad, who was subject to the rendition process and held at Guantanamo Bay. And recently, there was a news release from the administration that they're making some minor changes in the process of the state secret privilege. But this appears to be an effort to avoid having Congress try to codify the state secret privilege in law. And they're basically saying, well, trust us, because we won't abuse it quite as badly as the people before us did.
You basically covered all the important points. It was that the move is in order to block the Congress, which the Congress even doesn't seem really likely to pursue this, because it made some noise, especially within the alternative media, the whole issue of state secrets privilege. As you said, this is so very typical of our new president, President Obama. He constantly talks from both sides of his mouth. He says something, he does something else. And he's done that with almost every issue related to our civil liberties, in our, you know, especially on our constitutional rights. As you said, with the cases, not only that they have defended, they have kept the assertion of the privilege, state secrets privilege by Bush administration, they have actually requested to go even further by saying the government has sovereign immunity.
Mm-hmm.
This is basically a language that would be used by monarchs, by kings, not by an elected president, not in a country that considers itself a democracy.
And, Sibel, as we're speaking here in early October, there is just one crack in that wall, and it's Judge Vaughn Walker here in San Francisco. He's a district court federal judge.
Yes.
And he has repeatedly rejected the assertions of the FBI of state secrets privilege. And this is related to a now defunct Islamic charity called Al Haramain.
Yeah.
And I've done many interviews with John Eisenberg, the attorney, appellate attorney for that group. And to Judge Walker's credit, he has resisted these stunning demands and arrogant dismissals that have come from the Justice Department to him, and he is proceeding, I think very carefully, but still proceeding with this case. And if they are successful, the judge has indicated he does believe that they have standing, which means that they know that they were wiretapped, and therefore they do have a right to proceed. I imagine that other techniques will be used to stifle this process, but I'm modestly encouraged that we have one courageous judge, and he's a Republican appointee, by the way, who has stood firm on these issues.
Now, I want to tell you something. Right after the president came and gave this total cosmetic, total BS line on the changes to the state secrets privilege, a week after that, there is one case of state secrets privilege that's been pending in this court, and this judge, just like Walker, resisted the state secrets privilege. This is a case against Richard Horn.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Horn was a Drug Enforcement Agency, DEA agent, who was illegally spied upon by the CIA, and his operations were interfered. I won't even get to the case, and it has to do with Burma. So the Bush administration invoked the state secrets privilege. I believe it was either Clinton or Bush. And finally, this judge, in their case, said, you know, okay, state secrets privilege won't stand, and the documents have to be submitted for this case, and it's going to move forward. So the Justice Department, they moved to appeal the case, right? And Obama administration walked in, and this was 1 week after Obama announced the state secrets privilege cosmetic change that had no changes whatsoever, and I will explain that too. And they said, no, the privilege was invoked properly and that they were appealing. So they actually re-invoked the privilege 1 week after. Hmm. 1 week after he came and Holder had this announcement that got some cheers from the cheerleaders out there in the mainstream media. Now, with the cosmetic changes, they're saying basically the government should show more documents and justify it, okay? Peter, they did it in my case, okay? The judge asked the government, this is cosmetically, to justify it. Well, when the government goes to justify it, they do it in camera, okay?
Right. Yeah, you can't see the documents they use against you.
The defendants won't see it. The public will not see it. The reporters will not see it. It will not be on any court documents that is unclassified. People can't see it. So these officials can go in camera. They can sit in front of the judge and lie as much as they want.
Mm-hmm.
They can say, you know, the mushroom clouds will come out if this case moves forward. Here is the reason. And the judge, what is the judge going to say? Who's there to challenge? Who's there to raise objection? Who's there? And the judges, no matter who the judge is, they are not familiar with a lot of the intelligence-related areas. They don't even know what questions, what documents to ask for. So if Ashcroft or Gonzalez or Holder goes to a judge in camera and says, if this case moves forward, some of our intelligence and whatever secrets will be out, and China will have the mushroom clouds over us, they get away with it.
And, Sibel, in the case here in San Francisco, John Eisenberg told me about 2-3 years ago, the government filed a brief, and he was not allowed to see it. But the judge permitted him to write a series of responses to what he imagined to be in the brief.
I'm sorry. I feel sick of using the phrase Kafka-esque Kafka. It's because, you know, after a while, you use certain things, it just gets too old.
Yeah, it's not
but
fair
I
to...
But I don't know what else to use.
It's not fair to Franz.
Certainly not fair. I wish we would have a new one to write, because even he couldn't imagine this bad of a situation.
Yeah.
You know, it's just absurd. It is so unconstitutional. It's common law. Actually, it came from the Brits. Okay, it came from the King of England. That's what it is. It's not a law that was passed in Congress. A lot of people don't understand. This was a privilege for the kings, Peter.
Mm-hmm.
Obama also says, I'm a king. George W. Bush said he was a king. He got away. He did everything a king would do. And he got away with it. He was able to do it. Neither the Congress nor the court stood up against that, right?
The same thing
happening right now, Peter.
There were only a few exceptions. The Supreme Court surprised me with two or three rulings related to the detention system at Guantanamo. But beyond that, you're right. The courts were cowed, and the Congress was passive. And, you know, talking to some of the people we've interviewed for the Boiling Frog series, you come away with the clear impression that members of Congress don't want to know. They don't want to exercise oversight.
Same with the court.
We have to ask ourselves why. Sibel, next, I'd like to ask you to give us a couple of minutes of commentary here on your experience with the mainstream media in the United States revolving around your case. And I'll just begin by saying that it's sad and a real dereliction of their duty that while you have been in Vanity Fair and you were on 60 Minutes, that there has not been a concerted effort to investigate your case, to investigate these issues. And the blackout remains to this day, where we know that Bradblog.com and the American Conservative Magazine are really the only two places that have given in-depth coverage to your case and to these issues.
Except for the international media, correct?
Well, yeah, I am limiting my criticism to the American media.
Correct.
And certainly in Britain and in other countries, and I believe from what you've told me in Turkey, there has been significant coverage. But here in the United States, blackout remains in effect. And this is self-censorship on the part of the corporate media in this country.
Correct. It's also, it would be maybe good to explain how some of this relationship that I have or my experience evolved with the mainstream media. And this, the first initial part of it will, it will be kind of a classic of what happens with whistleblowers dealing with the mainstream media. Number one, you're totally inexperienced and naive. Number two, a lot of the whistleblowers, at least the ones that I know, they were, like me, totally anti-publicity. Okay, I want to go to court, get this thing settled. I want to go to the Congress, get Congress to do something. I don't want my name out there, right? Which was the case with me initially. And then when the need for media becomes apparent and the media comes after the information, the initial information, then you get the attorneys involved, and that is the attorneys who represent whistleblowers, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you know this very well, because we have had some cases, an attorney says, I have to be present, I have to, because, again, it's very important how the media reports on this stuff, because if they report it wrong, or some information comes out wrong, it can be used really against the whistleblower, too.
Indeed.
Right. So initially, I really, like Washington Post article, the one that John Cole was referring to, his name was in there too, came out in June 2002. Yeah, I refused to be interviewed. My attorneys were asked questions, but the most of their information came from the Senate Judiciary Committee and their own Justice Department sources, plus John Cole in the FBI. I was not interviewed because I said, I don't want to be interviewed. CBS 60 Minutes was my first public interview, and this was October 2002. And at that point, okay, in October 2002, I'm in this position, Peter, when they are telling me the IG report is going to come out anytime, okay?
Right.
All right. The Senate Judiciary Committee is going to have this gigantic public hearing and announcement. It's coming up, right? And I have just filed my case with the court. And so I was like, this information is going to come out. Just wait.
And we wait.
Yeah, so the people wait and the reporters wait. And my attorneys just give some, you know, outlines of, you know, what this thing is without going into any detail, saying, just wait, the report is going to come out, the Senate. That's when it's going to basically explode, which didn't happen. And I still kept quiet. I did not give any interviews. If you go and look at my interviews, they started all in 2004, when, after the state secrets privilege was invoked for the second time, after the Congress was gagged, and after I became friends with the 9/11 family members, the Jersey Moms, and decided that nothing was going to happen. The Judiciary Committee deserted me. The IG report was all classified. They were not releasing it to the public. I said, okay, the media is the only way. So that's when it really started with the media. And it started in a very naive way, because I really couldn't understand why I would spend hours explain things to them and tell them what is really important. And then in the end, they would write, all of them had identical stories, Peter. It would be the story of this poor little whistleblower. okay? You know, how basically I notified my bosses and I was subjected to polygraph and they confiscated. They're important stuff, but those were not the reasons why I blew the whistle.
Mm-hmm.
And information that I would give them, for example, okay, who? Nobody ever asked, who is Malachian Dickerson and Douglas Dickerson? Even though I would provide them with that information. It was Washington Post, New York Times. You just named them, Peter. And in the end, they would print this story like, okay, but New York Times was the state secret's privilege, the legality of it, the fact that the Congress was gagged. But they never would do investigative work of who are Dickerson, who is Grossman, okay? Why the state secret's privilege was invoked? Nobody, people would print front page of New York Times, saying that Congress was gagged and state secret's privilege was invoked. It's unprecedented, right?
Yeah.
None of those articles would say why or ask the question why. Why would the Attorney General do it twice? Why did he would do this unprecedented move and gag the Congress? No whys were being asked. Just report that I'm being quashed, I'm being gagged, I'm being privileged. The Congress is being stopped. But nobody would ever ask the question, what is the information? Mm-hmm. What is this about? None. So, it, as you said, it has continued to date. And after 2006, it was like, well, we have covered this story. We already covered, we reported New York Times, the Washington Post, state secret's privilege was invoked, and IG report, but nobody has covered the case. I mean, even the Vanity Fair piece. Because in the end, it has to go through so much legal stuff in terms of, can we be sued? Okay, so you have two FBI agents and one person from the Congress who are confirming this, but they want to be anonymous, right? They don't want their names there because they're current, right? They're mm-hmm. current people. They're currently employed. Well, we won't print that. That's a double standard because these people, they print the current high-level officials from the White House, Justice Department, who leak information to them, without any other sources who would corroborate. For example, they would, you know, like Judy Miller, so say, oh, yeah, this thing with the Niger or whatever, she would go and write it. Would she have the same standards saying, okay, if it's, let's say, Klein case or Russell Price case or Sabelle Edmonds, not only that they want witnesses by name, minimum of three, okay? Mm-hmm. Minimum of three. That was Vanity Fair's rule, minimum of three. At least two of the three have to go with their name. Nobody would do. Look what happened to me. They can look and see what happened to me. How could they ever dare doing that? Because this is what happens. I fought harder than anyone else, and no justice, no accountability, nothing. So why would they do it and risk their careers? On the other hand, if it's somebody under Ashcroft leaking stuff, none of those standards. Yeah, let's see some more documents. We want more proof. We want more sources on the Niger. No, that won't happen, Peter. Different set of standards.
Well, and the government intimidates them at least sufficiently that they do stay in line, and they require an excessive burden of proof, which they wouldn't apply to almost any other story.
That's right.
The other piece of this is that you know, I would expect that there are journalists who want to make a mark. They want to win a Pulitzer Prize, or they want to, you know, move from a small paper to the New York Times. And this is the kind of story that could make a career.
No, it won't. And you know that, Peter. Okay, let's look at, because I wrote a piece on this. I covered this mainstream media in 7-8-part series, okay? I'm sorry, I forgot his name. Fantastic reporter who exposed the military contractors to all the networks. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2008, didn't he?
Yes, I can't think of his name either, but a New York Times reporter. And
you just go and listen to his interviews.
Barstow,
yes,
David Barstow.
Right. Uh-huh. If you listen to his interviews with Amy Goodman and others, he's saying the mainstream media is not covering. Only the alternative media has requested interviews with him.
Well, it's true, and the important charges he made that the Pentagon was picking the generals who were appearing on television to critique the war were getting talking points from Rumsfeld and it was all very carefully orchestrated and wired.
Right.
And the very networks that fell victim to this, whether willingly or not, refused to set the record state with their viewers.
Right.
And say, yeah, this is what happened, and we apologize.
Exactly. And guess what? He won the Pulitzer Prize. He did a fantastic work. I have so much respect for this guy. He's, in fact, more so today than even when he won it, because of how he's not compromised and he's not being covered by the mainstream media. And guess what? It didn't make his career. It ruined, in a way, his career.
Mm-hmm.
Now, hopefully, he will be able to do a great book, and he will sell. Most likely will be a bestseller and will support it. But no, it didn't. You know, you get actually marginalized. You may get the first standing ovation, you know, but then they don't want to touch you because even they become radioactive. You know how Bob Perry became radioactive, despite the fact that he won awards for his story.
Mm-hmm.
It happens simultaneously. You are given the initial hooray, and after that you're given the finger saying, we don't want to deal with you.
Yeah.
And that has been the case for decades. This is not a new phenomenon. To me, and for me, the worst part has been the so-called alternative media, or those who are advertising themselves as the progressive alternative online. They actually are the worst ones in this case.
And why is that? What do you believe motivates their disdain?
I think you cannot limit it to one reason and explain all of them with one reason, because it's more complicated, more complex than that. Several factors, okay? One factor is, first of all, when one of or some of these blog online publications becomes popular, okay, they become target, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen, because I have friends who have become successful with these. So what happens is, you start getting actually more funding. When you get more funding, and then you're more popular, you start then hiring more people. So you expand, and you become, in a way, a small corporation, right?
Yeah.
So now you have the payroll to take care of. Now you actually depend more on the funding. When they first start, they don't have anything to lose.
Right.
You get the idealistic, passionate, fantastic guys and ladies out there writing. What do they have to lose, right? But once they start having several editors and several reporters on the payroll and the webmaster and all those stuff and dedicated servers and the salaries, how do we last for the next year? Okay? Then the funds become extremely important. Then they have a lot to lose. And when you get to that point, you are no longer that alternative media. You have become part of the same system. Same with select reporters, okay? And I mark it this way. If you see a bunch of those who started with the blogosphere start showing up on NBC, MSNBC, know that they are finished. Move on to the next guy. No. I mean it, Peter. Because, as I said, some of these people are friends. Actually, I'm going to go ahead and name one, okay?
Okay.
A fantastic guy who used to work for CQ, Justin Root. Do you know him?
I don't.
Okay. Justin Root then moved, I believe, to Salon, or CPM, with Josh Marshall, right?
Mm-hmm.
He became so popular. He ended up having a lot of followers, right? Suddenly, when he started collecting these followers, the ABC people, this is, I believe, Brian Ross, went and said, we want you, we love you, please work for us, we'll give you big-time money. Well, okay, he's a young guy, he's just got married, he needs money, right? And it's a good, cushy position, too. So he took the job with ABC's Brian Ross. Well, Justin Root hasn't been the same since. Justin Root was a very good friend, okay? He doesn't cover those stories anymore.
Yeah.
He doesn't deal with my whistleblowers, whether it's Russell Tice, the way he used to deal when he was with the CTU. He was my guest for my whistleblowers retreat I had for 3 days. But things start changing. They hook you. Because when you're successful, they want you because they want those followers, okay? This is for their ads and for all the right business reasons, right?
Mm-hmm.
And once they come and offer you those positions, then you're no longer the same. That's how it works. It's nothing abnormal about that. Meaning, those people who follow these guys, once they get too big, they're going to move to the next one because they outlast their effectiveness. They become too big, and once they become too big, they're no longer what they started as. The same thing happened with nonprofit organizations. You get these passionate people starting this NGO, set up the office, doing great work, you know, passionately going to Congress, the founders of these organizations. They bring this. But once the organization organization becomes successful, they start getting the funding, and they get 10, 15 employees, their budget becomes $1.2, $1.3 million. They did a statistic on this. They spend more than 90% of their time on fundraising. There's not much time left to do those fights in Congress, do the stuff, write the stories, because they have to maintain those staff salary.
Mm-hmm.
So it ends up becoming sustaining themselves, so they have to sustain themselves. Once they get to that point, people move. Go find new people, okay? I was invited to the the Organization for Women in New York speech, and there were 15,000 women showed up in 2004. Okay, I was so nervous. I was standing there, and this woman came to me and hugged me and kissed me and said, I would like to have you on my show, which I showed up on her show a few days later, Rachel Maddow.
Uh-huh.
And she was really, really good. Well, is she the same person she was 5 years ago?
Well, I will answer that by saying, has she invited you on her television
show?
But I'm
not talking about me. I'm not talking about, let's keep me out of that. I'm just saying, in general, there are mm-hmm. all sorts of other issues, too.
Yeah.
There are all these other whistleblowers. There are some of them that are not even public that I have tried to channel to some of these people that I used to know.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't touch them.
I'll say this about Rachel. I think she does a good job on the issues she covers, but there are many omissions of important issues that I think she would have covered on her radio program a year or two ago that do not get covered on her MSNBC television show.
But, you know, Peter, I'm not talking about Rachel, but in general. First, people, they sit down and they break down these networks, right? They say how they're corporate-owned, okay? And because of that, who owns them? A lot of them, military-industrial complex, et cetera, right? Right? It's the same MSNBC, ABC. Well, it's the same corporate. So if these people really did what really needs to be done, they would not be there. I talked with some senior producer, and it was very simple. With Oberman was, listen, we want to tap in this market, okay? There is this, you know, progressive, and they are not, you know, something, and we can tap in, and we can gain, let's say, 1.5 million extra people.
Mm-hmm.
For that, we need somebody who can bring in these people, because we don't have it. Welcome Oberman's new style that popped up. A showman. He is a showman. And it is tapping to that segment that they didn't want CBS to tap, because it's a pretty large segment. That is the whole purpose.
Well, and also, yeah. Just in business terms, they were blocked on the right by Fox.
And
they first attempted to go after Fox, and when that failed, they said, okay, we'll take these other people on the left.
But you know what? It worked, because a lot of people, they get so excited. They get passionate. They're like, wow. You see, it's like very Shakespearean. He's a showman. He's not a journalist.
No, he's a sports guy.
Right. He's a showman. He can do the voice and say, okay, Mr. Bush, I am asking you this question. And that gets people excited for like a few minutes. And then, of course, there's time for commercial. And there you go. You've got cornflakes. That's it.
Yeah.
The end of story.
Mm-hmm.
You think they're going to ever cover these stories? Never in your lifetime. It's the same thing. It's not any different than it was before when we had the real Iran-Contra issues, when we had the BCCI scandal.
Yeah.
There are certain issues, and my case is one of those, that would never be covered by these people. It's just too dangerous for
mm-hmm.
them. It's too hot for them.
Yeah.
You know, there are other issues that, okay, it's safe to play with. Yeah, who's going to go after them, really?
Yeah, they'll do an in-depth series on Michael Jackson because he's dead.
That's some safe. Of the other points that are kind of safe, you know, like this thing that became popular even on torture. There comes a point, it's like, okay, this level is safe, and they'll go, and then they will throw all of them into that.
Right.
For a certain period of time. So anyway, what I'm trying to say is the worst part is actually with the alternative media and some of the larger blog space. But again, they are not going to last, because mm-hmm. it becomes like that. Because people, they're not stupid. They smell it, and they're like, oh, this is not what it used to be. Then they start looking for another newcomer that they can go to and trust and say, yeah, these issues are being covered. So they won't stay for a long time. Maybe they will merge with NBC or Fox. I don't know.
Sibel, finally, I'd like to ask you to quantify for us in your own terms what this has cost you. Because as we discussed earlier, you were offered a payment for your silence, and you rejected it. And you have pursued these issues in a dogged and determined way, despite the real cost in personal terms and financial terms that you have endured. Now, you told us a little earlier that it's cost you at least $275,000 in legal fees. But that's only part of it. You also told us you alluded to a problem with your sister, and I know that you don't feel that you can go home to Turkey right now, where your aging mother lives. So describe for us the real human cost, the toll that you have paid in pursuit of justice and the truth.
Right. Well, basically, you covered all the points. I have never talked publicly in details about this, and I won't do that because that really makes me emotional. And I have had people asking me, I did one of those womanly articles for this womanly magazine. I'm sorry to say womanly. I shouldn't do that. It sounds sexist. Glamour magazine.
It's okay.
Five-page article in 2005, early 2005. And it was, it just, and she gave up, the reporter. Who was her name? Sheila Weller. Very nice lady. She's like, but I want to see some tears. I mean, you don't let yourself cry because after reading all the stuff and do this stuff, you know, going through the story, it's how can you even not break down and cry and or scream? As far as screaming goes, I tried so very hard to swallow all the screaming that I really wanted to do. Because when you're doing this fight, as I said, they were trying to dig up dirt on me. They couldn't do it. They would have loved those Ashcrofts and the people who had invoked the privilege to see me come out and scream and cry and rant. So that will be their excuse. Look at this woman. She's insane. She's hysterical, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was being labeled to try to control the anger. And my God, anger, I have had a lot of those. And they have been always quashed internally. And one way I have dealt with it has been to keeping very busy and keep fighting so I don't have time to get depressed, that I wouldn't have time to sit down and cry and feel sorry for myself because I have a lot to feel sorry for because my roots were and are extremely important to me. You have been to Turkey. You know the Mediterranean culture of this very, very close family ties. The extended family members, that's like your great uncles and your mm-hmm. aunts and your grandmother and your great grandmother. I was going to Turkey 2 to 3 times per year until 2000. I was extremely close to my family members, and that was taken away from me. I am hated in Turkey because of the way I have been depicted. A woman who is against Turkey and is an enemy of the Turks. And that has hurt my family members there extremely. To read, and they get the pictures from the web, the enemy of the Turks, a woman who sold out. She's an agent against the Turks. She should be ashamed of herself. She's not even a Turk. I have family members there who get to see that, who get to hear that on radio shows, very popular, the mainstream media in Turkey. So, yes, very painful. And first of all, officially, they have blacklisted me. I would go to jail because based on Turkish law, I committed treason against Turkey because if you eavesdrop on Turkish officials, government people, or foreign government, because they consider U.S. a foreign government, you consider an agent for that foreign government committing treason. And if you have Turkish citizenship, you have committed treason. So under treason laws, I am wanted in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
And the emotional cost of it, I can't even begin to describe that. Financial cost of it, the physical cost of it, I went through a lot of those. But it's always been, don't talk about it, don't show it, and focus on the fight. And there were so many areas to focus. I was fighting in court. Okay, I was fighting and doing the stuff with Congress. And then later it was trying to do this stuff publicly. And then establishing the organization, the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, Well, the latest is the new blog site that I started last May, and it's been growing. So it's been always trying to find something to channel it and to say, well, a lot of, excuse my language, shit, but how can you make something good come out of all this horrible stuff?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe something good can come out of it. And I have to admit, some good have come out of it. Guess what? Right now I'm talking with you, not only now, but even when we talk as friends. Mm-hmm. I know you because of this. I wouldn't have known you.
Yeah.
I have a great friend, Dan Alsberg. The only reason I got to know and become very good friends with Dan is because of my case. I've got to touch a lot of lives, and a lot of lives ended up touching me. And this may sound corny to people, but when the time passed and when you try to step out, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to step out and step back and look at it. I mean, you just see that with all the horrendous bad stuff, there's always some really good stuff that wouldn't have come without those horrifying bad stuff. So it hasn't been all lost. There's been some really good stuff coming out of this. But as far as the real objective of bringing about accountability, no. And it hasn't happened. And I don't see how it can happen. It's been 8 years. I mean, some websites, still they go and they retrieve my information. They're like, Sibel Edmonds, 32 years old, translator from the FBI. I'm like, hello, it was 7 years ago. I'm 40 now. You know?
Right. People lock in on a certain point
in
time.
It's like a picture of Dorian Gray. In some of these websites, I still stay young.
Amelia Earhart. Well, Sibel, thank you for this wide-ranging conversation. Thank you for sharing with me this powerful story and the complex elements that make it up. And I hope people will listen carefully to what you've had to say. And I do hope that ultimately we turn things around. I hope the media blackout is lifted. I hope that your case and others will be part of the wedge that pushes Congress back into oversight, and that also will rebuff the courts in their complicity with the overarching executive power grab that is represented by the efforts to silence you and to keep you from telling the truth about wrongdoing and criminal behavior that you became aware of. What you did was consistent with your commitment when you joined the FBI. And as John Cole has told us, your treatment is quite similar to what happened to him and to others who believed that they could come forward with serious charges and be treated with respect and with constitutional due process. And what we've learned is a dark series of lessons in how our government actually operates and to the extent to which it is unduly influenced by non-American interests.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for having me. And yes, we need a real revolution to get the real change.
Sibel Edmonds, speaking freely here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Thanks for listening, and let me know your comments. My email's always available, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.